So today, looking at the mind center, I again want to offer this perspective of the heart-mind, not so much of a distinction necessarily. And one of the things I'd like to kind of highlight here, just right at the beginning, is that, you know, for us, I think the notion of the awakened heart evokes something, and the notion of the awakened mind evokes something perhaps a little bit different. And for me, it does anyway. And I think it kind of relates a little bit to what I was talking about last night with respect to waking up to the human side of impermanence and the kind of the more universal notion of impermanence, that when we recognize the humanness of impermanence, it touches our heart. In a way, I think of these two, the awakened heart and the awakened mind, the awakened heart and the awakened mind, as being kind of like two sides of a coin, that they're not separate, but they may manifest a little differently in our experience. And the awakened mind deeply understands the truth of impermanence, deeply understands the truth of unreliability, of all experience as being a place that will make us happy, and deeply understands that there isn't anything actually to cling to, that everything is ephemeral, coreless, process, no self, not me, not mine, not who I am. And through that understanding, the mind lets go of trying to hold on to these impermanent things, tries to let go of holding on to things that are just slipping through our grasp. So that letting go brings a sense of freedom, of ease, of peace. And that I think of as being the awakened mind, the mind that understands non-clinging as freedom. And that mind that understands that, in meeting the world, in meeting our humanness, responds to the world with the appropriate response of love, of compassion, of joy when there is things to be joyful about, of compassion when there is suffering. And so this awakened heart and awakened mind, I feel, are just kind of almost, what perspective are we looking at the world through? What lens are we looking at the world through? One teacher, I believe it was Nisargadatta, said, "Love tells me I'm everything. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Between these two, my life flows." And so today I'd like to talk about the wisdom side of the picture, but remembering that this wisdom is not separate from the compassion and the love. It's just a different doorway, a different way in towards understanding. I think when we really open to love, we also open to truth in many ways. When we open to truth, we open to love. So one of my teachers, Saito Utejaniya, says that the whole purpose of our practice is to develop wisdom. That's what we are doing as we practice here. And as I think I mentioned last night, the Buddha said, you know, what I teach is suffering and the end of suffering. So the wisdom that we're developing, the wisdom that we're cultivating, is directly related to this question of suffering, the question the Buddha was trying to solve in his own life, was this suffering that we seem to be engaged in our lives, is it possible for this to come to an end? And he found in his own experience that possibility exists for that suffering to be released for freedom. And so the wisdom that is of interest to the Buddha, what he conveyed to us in his teachings over the 40-some years of his teachings, was wisdom around understanding suffering. Not an intellectual understanding, but an understanding that comes through this internal exploration, this non-English language communication that our bodies and minds have with us. So understanding suffering, letting go of the cause of suffering, because when we begin to understand suffering, we see it is not random in our lives. It is a result of cause and condition. There's a cause and effect relationship about how suffering comes to be in our lives. And the Buddha, in his understanding, recognized that suffering will come to an end when the causes for suffering come to an end. And he understood that to be wanting things to be other than they are, is the craving. And it's kind of counterintuitive to us, you know? It's like we think wanting things to be the way we'd like them to be, that's the way towards happiness. But the Buddha actually discovered, no, it's actually the wanting itself that's in our way. The very wanting things to be different is the very thing that creates the struggle. And just play with it in your mind, you know. There's a situation where you want something, and just imagine that wanting going away. Would there be a problem if there wasn't that wanting? This is the recognition, this is the insight that we meet in our practice. It's quite remarkable when we start to see how wanting things to be different is the cause of our suffering. Not the things that are not the way we want them to be. That's not actually the cause of our suffering. It's the wanting it to be otherwise that we fight with truth. Essentially, we're fighting with reality. We're fighting with truth. That fighting is the cause of our suffering. And so he suggested understanding this and seeing as we understand suffering, we really begin to see this clearly in our own experience. We see the truth of this. So we begin to see the way towards letting go of that wanting, that craving. Then realizing the freedom. There's another aspect of this wisdom. Actually realizing the release from that suffering. Some of you may be recognizing that I'm walking my way through the Four Noble Truths. This teaching of the Four Noble Truths is one of the key definitions of wisdom in the Buddhist teachings. And the realizing the freedom, the happiness, the ease that results when we let go is a part of that wisdom that develops. It's the expression of that wisdom, the freedom that comes as we let go. That freedom, that release feels wonderful. I was doing walking meditation on one retreat, and watching the mind want to look at the people in the vicinity of where I was walking. And this was a 3-month course, and initially in this 3-month course, I was like, you know, I'm going to be a good yogi. They told us not to look at people. I'm not going to look at people. And so it was like I was doing this blinders on kind of walking meditation. And, you know, some weeks into the retreat, it's like, you know, weeks of not going to look, be a good yogi. They told me to do it this way. I finally realized, wow, you know, wanting is what's happening here. Maybe I should pay attention to the wanting. Finally, I woke up to the wanting and began to look at the wanting happening as I was in the vicinity of other people. I began to explore it, you know, get to know it, watch it. I saw its conditions coming into being. I saw that when I was walking by myself, you know, there wasn't any particular issue. Somebody popped into the field of my vision, sprung in. So I saw the condition of seeing someone as being a part of the construction of that wanting. And then the person would walk out of my field of vision and poof, the wanting would go away. It felt like being released from a vice grip, watching that wanting disappear. That's some wisdom. It's both wisdom at work when the wanting releases, and it's the experience of wisdom to see the release, feel the freedom from the wanting. For me, that was one of my clearest experiences of, oh my gosh, my mind, this mind is creating the problem. This mind is creating the problem, and thank goodness the mind can undo it. You know, it's like if the suffering were inherent in the way things are in the world, oh, it would be so difficult. You know, sometimes we feel we own the problem, right? It's like, you mean my mind? This mind is creating the suffering? Oh, I must be a bad person. But actually, it's good news that the suffering is created by our own minds, because it means that our minds can undo it. We can unwind from that. And this was kind of the insight that my mind saw in that moment. It's like, oh, the wanting goes away. And when the wanting went away, the suffering, it was this real release, real freedom, real ease, real peace. Joy resulted. So that realizing of the ending, the realizing of the release, is a part of this wisdom. And then the fourth noble truth, cultivating the path. And my teacher, Sayadaw Utejaniya, says that this cultivating of the path is the cultivation of wisdom. In various forms, it's the cultivation of wisdom. Cultivating wisdom, the mind, the cultivation of wisdom is responsible for the letting go of the clinging. The wisdom does the letting go. And again, it's like, it's an interesting thing that we take ownership of things and we think, I'm supposed to do the letting go. I remember sitting down in some retreats and feeling this clinginess, like, I don't know how to let go of this, you know, feeling this tightness and this gripping. It's like, I don't know how to let go of this. And at some point, the understanding arose that I can't know how to let go of it. Wisdom develops, wisdom lets go of it. Wisdom understands how to release the clinging. And so we cultivate the wisdom. We cultivate, one of the aspects we cultivate is this understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And a big part of that in our practice is understanding suffering in this way of meeting our experience over and over and over again. We meet our experience over and over and over again. The mind gains wisdom through that practice. The mind gets the understanding of how it's contributing to the suffering of the system. You know, in a way, this whole mind-body system, it wants to not suffer. You know, our whole way of oriented toward the world is to try to not suffer, but our mind, through confusion, through delusion, is fundamentally misunderstanding how happiness comes to be. We think having things is what's going to make us happy. But as we start to be mindful, actually turn towards the experience in the moment of what it is to want to try to create, to construct, to get the things we like, to get rid of the things we don't like, we begin to recognize the system. The mind-body system begins to recognize the suffering of that whole process, how painful it is to try to keep doing that. And the mind-body system, thank goodness, again, the mind-body system wants to orient towards well-being. And as we are mindful, as mindfulness comes into the picture, the mindfulness and wisdom together begin to understand our usual ways of finding happiness do not lead us towards well-being. And the mind itself begins to understand how to find its way towards ease, peace, happiness. It's not something our rational minds can figure out. But the practice of mindfulness begins to really educate the whole mind-body system. And that, when you step onto that path and engage with that, you're on your way towards the mind freeing itself. So the Pam last night mentioned one of the kind of definitions of waking up, you know, the spotless, immaculate vision of Dharma arose. Everything that arises is subject to cessation, kind of that insight around impermanence. There are a couple of other definitions of freedom in the texts. One of them is found in the first discourse of the Buddha, where he's talking about the Four Noble Truths. The third noble truth, he's talking about the ending of suffering. He says, "This is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving," the craving that created the suffering. "It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it." I like that last phrase, non-reliance on it. It kind of points out to us that we generally, in thinking about how to be happy, we rely on craving. What do we rely on for happiness? And is it worthy of our reliance? Another kind of concise definition for freedom, Nibbana is the Pali term, Nirvana is the Sanskrit translation of that same term. And the word itself, Nibbana, basically means something like cooling. It's apparently, you know, related to when a fire goes out. They talk about the fire cooling. Nibbana is that, it's related, that's a related word. So it has a sense of cooling, releasing. And there's an analogy around fire in the time of the Buddha that essentially fire clung to the wood. And the fire going out meant the fire was released. So there's a kind of a notion also of release in this term, Nibbana. So the Buddha's definition, I mean, the word Nibbana was not, the word Nibbana wasn't just exclusive to the Buddha. It was a kind of a, you know, this is what people were searching for, this freedom, this release. And the Buddha gave it his own definition. And he said, "The absence of greed, the absence of hatred, the absence of delusion, this is Nibbana." So he's not defining it in terms of something, he's defining it in terms of the absence of. And he says about this, "If greed, hatred, and delusion are given up, one aims neither at one's own ruin, nor at the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both. and experiences no mental pain and grief. This is Nibbana, immediate, visible in this life, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise. So, a couple of pieces to highlight here. The description here, freedom from greed, hatred, delusion. He says the experience of that is no mental pain and grief. So again, the absence of something, but even just using a thought experiment, what might it mean to be free of mental pain and grief? The description of that the Buddha sometimes called the greatest happiness. The greatest happiness. I think also in this, absence of greed, hatred, and delusion, we can reflect on what the qualities of heart would be in someone that doesn't have greed, hatred, and delusion in their hearts. It would tend to be open, receptive, connected, friendly, compassionate. The other piece I'd like to highlight about this text is that he says, visible in this life. And I like that too about what the Buddha has to say about freedom. When I first thought of this word enlightenment, it somehow evoked things of transcendence and, blissful radiance. And, it didn't have anything to do with living in the world, that word, initially, as I heard it. It had nothing to do with living in the world. It was like floating in a cloud of bliss, kind of my idea of what enlightenment was, just from hearing the word. Absence of greed, absence of hatred, absence of delusion, I can envision as being something unfolding in the midst of life. And that's what he says, visible in this life. It's not some transcendent otherworldly thing, this Nibbana. It's right here and now, possible right here and now. So, one teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, said, I'll just read this. It's paraphrased, but I'll read it to you. He said, anyone can see if states of greed, aversion, and delusion were with us all day and night, every second without ceasing, living things must either die or become insane. Let us consider that we survive because there are periods that the fires of greed, aversion, and delusion are not burning. So he was pointing to the possibility or the fact that there are moments that exist for us in our everyday lives where greed, aversion, and delusion kind of naturally fall away. And he says the evidence of this is that we're not insane. He calls these moments temporary Nibbana. And Joseph Goldstein elaborates on this a little bit. And Joseph says, yes, these moments happen actually, but they are so subtle. Absence of greed, absence of aversion, absence of delusion is not something we're terribly attuned to. We're much more attuned to what we like, what we want to get rid of. That's where we live our life, through the relationship of things from that perspective. And so non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, Joseph says, it's a pretty subtle experience. We simply miss it. It's happening in our day, as he says, as Buddhadasa points to. It's happening, but we just miss it. So it's the non-seeing of it, We stay caught in this world of wanting and pushing away and figuring out and fixing and trying to arrange. And So the Buddhadasa says they're there. We just kind of have to open to, begin to see, begin to recognize that they're happening. And so that's some of what I'd like to talk about today. How do we begin to see those moments? How do we begin to see those little tiny shifts? And I'd like to just go through some of the ways I've seen, and to me this is related to how is wisdom experienced? How does wisdom get experienced in our practice? And so when wisdom is present, we end up often having a somewhat of a shift of perspective around our experience. And so I've seen this happen in some different ways in my own practice, and I'd like to just talk about some of those ways that I've seen these shifts of perspective. So wisdom develops through contact with dukkha, contact with suffering. It's not a mistake that we are meeting suffering in our practice. It is actually the unfolding of the path to meet our suffering. And Joseph sometimes says, we want insight into dukkha without experiencing dukkha. And it's not going to happen. That's part of the path. And for me, it's been helpful just to remind myself of that. You know, actually, one of the ways we bring, you know, wisdom comes into our practice in different ways. It comes into our practice through, you know, seeing shifts of perspective that I'll describe here in a moment, but it also comes in through hearing about new perspectives. I mean, just hearing that, you know, the way that I've been going about arranging my life, that's not so helpful. You know, or one of my early meetings, I think I might have mentioned this in the hall. I think I did mention it in one of the interview groups, that in the very first months of my practice, somebody had sent me a book. And I was, you know, reading through that book and looking at what it had to say about working with difficulty, and anger was what was really up for me. And that the picture I got from the little bit of wisdom that I pulled out of that book was something along the lines of, rather than acting on your anger, why don't you look at it? And it's like, okay, what good is that going to do? You know, it didn't make sense to me. That little bit of wisdom didn't make sense to me. But I was willing to explore it, willing to engage it. So, you know, bringing in that perspective, the first way we gain wisdom is through hearing a different perspective. You know, until I met this practice, I didn't question that the way I was going about happiness was the only way to find it. And then hearing, well, there may be a different way. It's like, well, I don't understand how it works, but that way sure hasn't worked. So I'm willing to give it a try, see what happens. So initially, wisdom is brought into our lives through hearing a new perspective, hearing some of the teachings. And then we begin to reflect on that. We think about it. You know, my first thinking about it was, well, what good's that going to do? Fortunately, my second thought was, well, nothing else has worked. I might as well try that. Let's see. Let's see what happens. So, you know, we bring in, we hear new teachings, hear a new perspective, and we reflect on it. And we may begin to engage with it, may begin to think about it. And sometimes what happens with wisdom that comes in through, you know, hearing talks or reading books, you know, it's like maybe it doesn't make so much sense right in the moment, but it like goes into the back of our mind. It just kind of percolates through our mind somehow. And at some point, having that percolating through our system, we start to see things in a different way. So the, you know, taking in that knowledge and reflecting on it kind of begins to subtly, slowly reorient how we look at the world. So sometimes we bring wisdom in consciously. We have heard something in a talk, and now it's like, okay, maybe I can use the perspective that this too is impermanent. You know, we're experiencing something that feels, we feel really caught to, really like, yeah, and this is, it's going to be like this forever. Seeing that thought, it's going to be like this forever, we can kind of counter it with the wisdom of, no, everything that arises is subject to passing away. This too is impermanent. And we may see through bringing in that kind of wisdom reflection consciously. So this is using our conscious thinking mind to orient more towards wisdom. Sometimes when we do that, it kind of allows the mind to go, oh, okay, right. It gives just a little bit of space for something different to happen. So we can bring wisdom in consciously through reflection, through actually thought in our mind. And there's different, you know, different perspectives of that. Three basic fundamental perspectives, you know. It's impermanent. It's unreliable as a place for happiness. And it's not me. It doesn't belong to me. It's not mine. It's not who I am. These three perspectives can help to open, sometimes open us up to, okay, a kind of a willingness to be with something, something difficult. Remind ourselves about that perspective. It's like, okay, yeah, I can be with this now. So one of the kind of main early ways I think we see wisdom operating is feeling a kind of shift of perspective around something difficult. You know, we're hanging out with loneliness and kind of caught by that loneliness. And something in us, some reflection, reminds us, well, this too can be looked at. We may just kind of step back and say, well, what is this loneliness? What is it? And then we may get a sense of, ooh, a little bit of space, a little bit of ease. It feels a little bit less sticky to us. This is one of the, this is a symptom of wisdom. I like that framing of it. Somebody actually asked the question in the hall at one retreat, what are the symptoms of wisdom? I like that way of putting it. And so one of the symptoms of wisdom is the sense of a shift of perspective around what we're looking at. It's like, oh, this is just anger. This is just loneliness. This is just sadness. This is just fear. A little bit of a sense of recognizing it is just something that's happening, and kind of a step back of not identifying with it quite so much. I sometimes think about it. I mean, it's not that the pattern disappears. It's not that the anger goes away necessarily with that shift of perspective, or the frustration, or the fear, or the confusion. Not that difficulty, whatever it is, may still be rolling. It's kind of like it's got its own momentum. And we just kind of step back. And to me, it's kind of like putting a car into neutral. You know, when the car's not in neutral, we've got our foot on the accelerator, the gears are engaged, and, you know, the gears are spinning together, you know, like this. The gears are in locked in place, and they're propelling each other. And you think about what happens when you put the car into neutral. The gears are disengaged. But the car doesn't like come to a stop, right? I mean, you put the car into neutral and it keeps going. But it will come to a stop because you're no longer fueling it. You're no longer giving it the gas. And it's kind of like that with that perspective of this is just whatever it is. It's like the this is just is putting the mind into neutral. The momentum of that pattern is probably going to continue. And yet it takes a little bit of trust and a little bit of a sense of confidence that putting the mind into neutral, you know, this is just, allows it to unwind on its own. And if we're no longer fueling that pattern, it will come to a stop of its own accord. And our job in that time is to watch it come to a stop. It's kind of like watching that settling of the mud. You know, it's like watching the spinning of a gear. You know, oh, what is this? What is this spinning of loneliness like? What is this spinning of confusion like? Can we just be with that? So this is one way that wisdom is experienced. Sometimes we experience wisdom. Wisdom is manifesting through recognizing that what's happening is simply happening in the present moment. So this is a kind of another flavor of wisdom that we see, for instance, around thoughts. You know, thoughts are often the place where it's like, I think I talked about this in one of the discussion groups. Thoughts are kind of like a bubble, you know, a cartoon bubble, a balloon. And what often happens if we're not aware, not mindful, not present, is like we move into the bubble. We move into the thought bubble. And we're living in that world in our minds, kind of almost believing its reality. Not even almost. We are believing its reality. So we're not aware that it is simply a thought that's arising in the present moment. You know, memories come up, like we relive our memories. It's almost like we're going, you know, back into time. You know, that's what the past is. It's a thought arising in the present moment about something that we have a memory about. So it's simply arising in the present moment, but we don't see it as that. We see it as we move in to the thought. It becomes our reality. So wisdom, when wisdom is operating from this perspective, it's recognizing this is just a thought. This is a thought that's arising in the present moment. We kind of recreate the past. I mean, what is the past? I mean, the past, what we call the past, I mean, we kind of feel somehow that the past is like, we think of it as behind us, you know, somehow. We think of the past back there, future's out there. And we think of it as being something real. It's odd the way our minds do that, but it's a kind of a perspective that our minds bring to it, that the past exists somehow. But the past only exists through the arising of thought in the present moment. You cannot point to the past. It's just the arising of thought in the present moment. Future is the same way. Future is just the arising of a thought in the present moment about what we envision might happen. And so the recognition of this is just an arising in the present moment. This is just something happening in the present moment. On one retreat, I was watching a particular pattern of thinking around an incident that had happened in the past in which embarrassment had arisen. And the memory would arise and I'd be so embarrassed. I'd feel the embarrassment all over again. And at some point I began saying, this is just a thought that's arising in the present moment. The embarrassment's being recreated here in the present moment. That was also a pretty powerful wisdom reflection, a recognition of wisdom, that the recognition that this thought is just coming up in the present moment. It's not actually happening again. It's just an arising that's happening. And the mind is reacting to that thought that's arising in the present moment and feeling embarrassed. There was a kind of a recognition that in that experience, it's like this is an arising in the present moment, the thought's arising in the present moment, and the embarrassment is also simply arising in the present moment as a response to that thought here and now. So I kind of had it in my mind that that whole memory, the whole thing of that embarrassing situation, it all came locked together. That somehow that situation, inherently had the embarrassment in it. But in this seeing with wisdom, the mind saw, no, the thought is arising in the present moment, and the embarrassment is a response to that thought right now. Seeing that suffering is created now. That's also a wonderful thing. Doesn't sound like it, but now, the fact that suffering is created in the moment is again the place where we can unhook from it. The only place where we can unhook from it. This is why we keep coming into the present moment, why we encourage your opening to what's happening in the present moment. It's the only place freedom can happen. And it is the place that suffering is constructed. It's all that's happening, actually. Now is the only thing happening. That's it. Everything that's happening is just an arising in the present moment. So that's another way that wisdom expresses itself. Another flavor to wisdom is that we begin to see, and this one is kind of pointed to by that last example, that it's just kind of different orientations. Sometimes when wisdom arises, it has one particular orientation or flavor of like seeing the impermanent nature of something. And that's part of what this expression is. It's just arising in the present moment. And that example that I just pointed to also is pointing to seeing how suffering is also just a construction in the present moment. So that seeing of the unreliability, how suffering is created, is another kind of avenue in which wisdom expresses itself. It can express itself. We can have openings around the impermanent nature of things. We can have openings around the unreliability, suffering nature of experience, how that's created. And then we can also have openings around kind of cause and effect, the process nature of experience. So we begin to watch and see how the mind, like in that example, actually, the arising of the thought, seeing the arising of the memory about which I was embarrassed, and then seeing the condition arising in the moment of reacting to that thought and embarrassment arising. And that there was a cause and effect relationship there. It wasn't something I did. It wasn't something I said, yes, I'm going to think that thought and get embarrassed. It was cause and effect. The memory arose, the mind's habitual response patterns kicked in, and that generated embarrassment in the moment. And so we see through watching our minds that things are an unfolding of cause and effect. This kind of recognition can feel a little bit odd at times. We kind of see things unfolding. It's kind of like just watching dominoes fall. It's like, who's doing this anyway? You know, at one point I was on retreat and I was doing most of my meditation in my room. I had some problems with my back and was doing lying meditation in my bed. And I had a roommate, this was in Burma. And my roommate was mostly doing her meditation in the hall, and she mostly wasn't around when I was doing my meditation in my room. You know, she would go to the hall right after breakfast and come back right before lunch. And so I pretty much had the room to myself all morning, which was great. I loved it. And one day she came back in. I heard the key in the door, you know, and I heard her like rustling to come in the middle of the morning, in the middle of my meditation. And my mind went, no! Don't come in. And I watched this whole set of consequences unfold from that. And it was the best way I could put it was just watching. It was like watching dominoes fall, seeing how the mind, you know, kind of bargained and maneuvered and tried to figure out how. There was enough settled backness, enough presence that I could just watch it unfold. It was like, wow, that's amazing. Look at how that unfolds. It wasn't that I was either trying to do or not do it. It was just unfolding. And there's this kind of joy in the seeing of that. You know, somehow that recognition of that kind of stepped back perspective of just watching it, watching causes and conditions, that recognition or that insight into just the impersonal cause and effect unfolding of experience, that is the beginning of the insight into not self. Now that's, we begin to see that what we take to be self is really a process that's unfolding, and the process is going to unfold whether we take it to be self or not. The imputation of a self actually comes after the fact. It's kind of like what happens from that example, if I hadn't been so present, would be, you know, there's all this reactivity unfolding, and someplace in that unfolding of all that reactivity, the mind would pick it up and say, I'm reacting to this. I'm doing this. I'm the one that's mad, confused, frustrated by my roommate. But in this case, it was just watching causes and conditions, and that sense of identification didn't happen. It was just watching that cause and effect unfold. So sometimes we also see wisdom in a, when wisdom gets stronger, when some unhelpful pattern arises and it is seen with mindfulness and wisdom, sometimes we can have the experience of it like going poof. It just vanishes. When wisdom is a little less strong, we may have that sense of the gears disengaging and watching something unfold. You know, in that case of watching all of the cause and conditions, you know, roll out, wisdom was fairly strong and able to see that and not identify with it. But there have been other times in practice when wisdom is so strong that on seeing any kind of unhelpful, unwholesome pattern in the mind, it's like, you know, taking the magic wand and going poof. You know, wisdom just obliterates, makes it vanish. It just poof. Kind of like going back to that car analogy. When wisdom is really strong, it's not like, you know, you've disengaged the gears and you're watching the car roll to a stop. It's not even like you've put on the brake and it's stopped. It's like the car disappears. It has no, it's just like the car's gone. So that's kind of, when wisdom gets really strong, you may watch, you may have a sense or see some difficult pattern arising, and the mind in seeing it, it just vanishes. So an example of this, which example? Well, here's one. I was on retreat, and it was between halves of the 3-month course, and I knew that I was going to be losing some of my teachers. They were leaving, and other teachers were coming, and I felt abandoned by the teachers that were leaving, and I felt lonely. I felt sorry for myself. I felt like a 4-year-old, you know, feeling bereft, you know, and I was kind of sitting there feeling that loneliness, you know, to some extent I was feeling that loneliness. And I was kind of felt like I was hanging out with myself as a 4-year-old. So that was kind of that first kind. There was a shift of perspective, you know, kind of like putting the car into neutral. I could be with that feeling of loneliness and feeling bereft, feeling like I was a 4-year-old, feeling sorry for myself. And, you know, there was some sense of compassion, actually, that was present with that. And so that was kind of that first step of stepping back. But at some point in this process, I was, you know, I was doing exercises while this was unfolding, and I was, you know, doing my stretching exercise. And at some point, it's like, well, what is this experience actually? You know, what is this sense? What is this emotion that I'm feeling? And the mind kind of got curious about, what is this anyway? And immediately it was gone. It just vanished. There was a strengthening of wisdom in the being willing to meet. And it just disappeared. And it's like, huh, that's odd. I mean, this is one of my early times of seeing that vanishing of something on something being seen. And I thought I'd done something wrong. You know, I thought, I went to my teacher and I said, you know, I don't know how to observe emotions. And she said, well, tell me what you experienced. And so I described it, and then I started to elaborate. And so, you know, after describing that this vanished, that, you know, obviously that, you know, what my mind told me is that obviously I had somehow repressed that feeling. And she said, well, was that your experience, that you repressed the feeling? I said, no, it felt like it just disappeared. And she said, trust your experience. That was like, wow, you know, that was a kind of a mind-opening experience for me. So sometimes it just vanishes. The difficulties just vanish. Sometimes wisdom can kind of operate in the background, you know, not, it's almost like invisible, like we're not really seeing it happen. There's one pattern, the pattern of anger that got me into this practice in the first place. And at this point, it's like I bow to that situation. Thank you. That situation. I mean, I'm grateful to that whole mess that I was in, that it had me meet the Dharma. But the anger, you know, lasted for a number of years. It was a specific person that I was angry with, you know, the over the course of years, I worked with the anger in a number of different ways, and at some point, I recognized, you know, when I try to bring my attention to this anger, it's kind of seeming to hook me into it. I'm getting hooked to it. And so maybe it's more helpful to, you know, just recognize it when it comes, bow to it, thank it, and say, you know, I'm just going to put my attention elsewhere. You know, kind of that, I've talked about that setting aside, not now. And so this is how I began working with my anger. And for quite a long time, probably a couple of years, I worked with this particular, the anger from around this particular person in this way. So when I'd see a thought about this person and feel the anger arise, I would, I see you and not now. And I would just like put it aside. And over the course of a long time, and I can't even remember how long at this point, I began recognizing, you know, kind of a slowing down, or that it was like not so present in my life anymore, this anger. You know, it would come up occasionally and it'd be, okay, I see you, not now. And then one day I was walking down my sidewalk and I remembered this person and I wasn't angry. And it's like, wow, you know, I haven't felt that anger in a really long time. And even in contemplating the person that I was angry with, it's like I couldn't even find it. I couldn't conjure it up. It's like, wow, where did it go? It had vanished when I wasn't looking. You know, my willingness to say, you know, I see you and set you aside. I mean, at one point I was kind of envisioning it being like this anger that was in me. It was like this big ball of thread that was wound up inside of me. And every time I met a little bit of that anger, it'd be like a little bit of that ball unwound. And my willingness to say, yep, I see you and not now, was like kind of like taking the scissors and cutting that and letting go of that. And that it just kind of began to unwind in that very slow way. But I didn't actually see it go away. I didn't actually even trust that it was gone. I mean, at that moment, in that moment when I thought, wow, it's been a long time since I felt that. Where did it go? I thought, well, it'll probably come back at some point. But it has not, it never came back. And in fact, what happened was a transformation in my mind around that person to when I think of that person at this point, what comes to mind is, I hope you're happy. You know, so there's a, it's been replaced by metta. And that was another kind of mind-blowing transformation in my life from this practice. And that was one where I kind of saw it after the fact. I mean, I didn't see that anger go away. But there was the wisdom of recognizing it is now gone. So that, it was helpful to recognize that. And helpful to see, oh, you know, how I had been reacting in the past, that's no longer there. And this is another way that we find and feel wisdom, is that we notice that we're different. Something happens in our lives. We have a conversation with somebody and we recognize, wow, you know, 5 years ago, if I'd been having this conversation, I would be really torqued out of shape. And now it's okay. That's another way that wisdom shows up. So these small moments of wisdom that happen, you know, it's not, my understanding is that those are not nibbana. They're not complete freedom. Like the moment of release around the wanting letting go in walking meditation, that wasn't nibbana. But it's like a pointer to the possibility of freedom. And it's a pointer to how the mind lets go and releases. And so orienting around recognizing how wisdom manifests, how wisdom arises in your practice will support your letting go, will support the deepening of the wisdom. It's like the recognition of wisdom cultivates the wisdom. As with the recognition of other wholesome qualities, you know, mindfulness is an amazing quality, amazing property of mind. It has the great property, that when we turn our mindful attention to things that are based in greed, aversion, and delusion, things that get us into trouble, things that, you know, create struggle and suffering, mindfulness of those experiences creates the conditions for them to appear less frequently in our minds. Mindfulness of the wholesome, mindfulness of love, of kindness, of generosity, of concentration, mindfulness of the wholesome tends to create the conditions for them to appear more frequently. Now, not mindfulness with wanting. You know, I think some of you have talked about, you know, many have recognized, you know, when we see, oh, look at that, isn't that great? More of that, it'll vanish. You know, it's like, you know, peace arises or concentration arises, go, oh, great, it's here. And then it's gone. It's the wanting that makes it vanish. It's not the mindfulness that makes it vanish. Actually, the mindfulness of the wholesome creates the conditions for the wholesome to appear more frequently. So likewise with wisdom, the more we recognize how wisdom comes up for us, the more it will deepen for us. So again, I'd like to encourage those of you who can stay in the hall now for a little while to just let the words settle and let go of the words. You can let go of the actual thinking about the words. Let it just percolate. You don't have to remember it in particular. The things that resonated will kind of percolate. The things that didn't, you can just let them go. So we have about half an hour before the meal, so sit as long as it feels appropriate for you. And thank you for your attention.